This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello! Welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. This week, we got into some great hypotheticals. One in particular about whether ants could run the world if they were the size of small dogs. Imagine it. We're going to get to that question very soon. We also talk about hay fever striking at particular points of the day and how your mood can affect your alcohol intake. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's get into it. You are listening to Triple J Mornings. We're about to launch into Science with Dr. Carl. And for this week's episode, I want to give a special shout out to our honorary doctors in Tassie, particularly if you're in Hobart. If you can get to our Triple J 50th on tour gig in Hobart at the Odeon, November 15, Courtney Barnett's going to be there, Luca Brasi, Emily Waramura, Gordon's grandson. If you want to win tickets, then you might want to submit a question for this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. If you have a science question, if you can get along to that gig, I'm giving away double passes to some of the best questions this week. So Tassie doctors, Hobart doctors, rise up. I want to hear from you. If you're in Hobart and you've got a science question for Dr. Carl, if it's the best one, you could win a double pass to our Triple J 50 on tour, kicking off in Hobart, November 15, with Courtney Barnett. So if you want to be in it to win those tickets, you can get to the gig, send in your science question with hashtag tickets at the end. And of course, taking your regular questions no matter where you are around the country. Dr. Carl is with you. Dr. Carl, how are you doing this week?
Ever so peachy keen. Very happy to be here.
What's something that you have learnt this week? You know, last week you were in New York, you beamed into the show. Is there something that you've learned on your travels that you're taking into this week?
The importance of family. Like, this was the first time in my life where I've spent 24 hours a day entirely with no free will obeying a 1.5-year-old baby and her mother. And it was so much fun. And normally, it's weird. When you're on holidays, you seem to have more time because when you visit family in your hometown, oh, nice to drop in, but I've got to go and see something else. But when you're on holidays, then there's nothing else. Mm-hmm. And it was just wonderful being drawn into the realm of this baby and trying to see the world through the baby's eyes.
But even though you did that, you still looked after your babies across the nation. Of course, I am talking about the Science with Dr. Carl fam. You still made time for us, answered our science questions, and now we've got you back on ground this week. Should we dive in?
IRL, let's go.
Let's go. We've got Rosie in Ngunnawal country. Rosie, you are a bit of a knitter, right?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about it.
I just want to say I'm a big fan of the podcast. I listen every week.
we love you.
Thanks, Rosie.
So, yes, I am a knitter, and I was talking with my dad recently who said he was talking with my brother and that if you take a piece of string or a piece of thread into space, it will try and straighten out. So I was wondering if I took one of my knitted jumpers into space, what would the fibers do?
I'm not an expert in this field of textile technology in microgravity, but going from first principles, there are tensions in the fabric that is knitted, if you're looking at a single string, when you've taken it from the animal or from the plant and you've done things and you've twirled it, and there are internal tensions that do not, as far as I can work out from just first principles, magically go away. So I'm thinking that this is a bit of a myth. I'm sorry to say that. Is that what they said, that if you get a string, it'll just magically straighten out?
Yeah, my dad was saying that, like, if you took a string into space, it'd, like, try and straighten out as best it can.
And would it go solid then, or would it still be malleable? Dr. Carl, do you know?
No, I'm guessing it would just still stay the same. It's got, like, your knitted fabric has got all this sort of complex structure. You've got loops, you've got stitches, you've got elasticity, and they're built into the structural integrity of the fabric. Now, what you've got around you is air and microgravity. There's no gravity effectively, and I don't see how that would make all of the internal stresses go away. I could be wrong on this. If somebody can chase this up on, I'm guessing, Google Scholar. Don't search Google, just Google Scholar and give us an answer. We'll love you to pieces and you might even get a Triple J fun pack if you're lucky. So we're onto it for you. We haven't got an answer yet. We're onto it for you.
Excellent.
Sorry. Thanks, Rosie. Thank you. How long does it take you to knit a jumper like that?
I think my quickest one would have been like 2 months.
Oh. And what sort of patterns do you do? like iconic foods that we Australians like to eat, or big advertising logos that are just for fun?
Not yet, but maybe that's something I have to get into.
Yeah,
or a car, or
bit of inspiration.
Something that the family likes.
Do you like cable knitting? And I've done the face of like an octopus jumper as well.
Octopus jumper,
so sick.
Yeah, it's
oh
cool.
God, yes.
Well, I would like to think that if it went into space, it wouldn't completely unravel. Rosie, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, doctors.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for listening to the podcast as well. You can do so wherever you get your podcasts or via the Triple J app. Kelly in Wantirna, what's your question?
Hey guys, so my question is, if ants were bigger, would they become the dominant species across the world? And if so, how big would they have to be for that to happen?
The trouble is being big. So a child has a better power to weight ratio than an adult. In the Olympics, gymnasts are short. And so when you go all the way down to the ants, they've got this terrific power to weight ratio. And they can carry 50 times their own weight, no trouble. Once they get bigger, they lose that. So what the ants currently have is a mixture of a very high power-to-weight ratio and a social structure. Oh, man. Their society is broken up into the workers, the soldiers, the people who run the nursery, the baby carers. There's all different parts of their society, but it's based on the fact that they can live in these complex hives and make their own air conditioning, but because they're so small, the hives can be small, like a couple of metres across. If you had the same number of them, but they were a metre tall, suddenly you're looking at something bigger than a skyscraper, and they couldn't do it. So basically, they've succeeded so well, and they've adapted into their size, and they've made an ecological niche that fits them. So how much bigger are you suggesting, like the size of a dog or something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like if they were the size of a small dog, because of their really good social structure and everything, and how they like run everything so organized and smoothly. Like if they were the size of a dog, would they take over us? Because like, we're nowhere near as organized as they are.
It's so true, and there's so many of them.
Yeah, because
yeah,
there couldn't be that many of them. You couldn't fit them, and you got to, in a society, you got to feed everybody and get rid of the wastes. And once you increase their size by a factor of, say, 100, everything just changes. They could not have that number of creatures living in such a close proximity. Even with humans, having come from New York, which you've got thousands of people in an individual apartment block, but the ants have got millions. It'd be like having the whole of Manhattan. There's just one ant colony, and even that wouldn't be big enough for the size of dogs, just going off the top of my head. So I don't think it would work, but we really need a physicist who knows the power law to do it.
Do you think there would be so many ants, though, that they would suffocate each other?
Waste
then
products
maybe then they wouldn't become the dominant species.
Mm-hmm. Their waste products could overwhelm. And part of one of the things that made the British Empire great in its later years was having a sewage system in London so you could have enough people to run the rest of the world. And at one stage, they did run a large percentage of the world. And out of the 200 or so countries in the world, the British did not, put it delicately, visit militarily, only a dozen. And one of them was the Vatican. And the other one was the Tongans, because the Tongans are just so tough. So they needed a sewage system to be able to run enough people in London, and that wasn't even a million people. So with ants, forget it. It wouldn't scale up. It wouldn't scale. Sorry.
Does that help, Kelly?
Does it help?
Sounds like the world would just collapse if it was run by ants.
Yeah. I also like where your head's at, Kelly. I like this hypothetical.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Kelly.
You. We got Kirsten in Bulleye. Kirsten, we've just been speaking about ants. You've got a question about frogs.
Frogs, yes. I'm kind of curious. We've got a lot of frogs in our garden, and we have a lot of metal pot plants. And the tree frogs get into the metal pot plants, and their call is literally 10 times louder. It reverberates in the metal. I'm wondering if they're doing that by chance, or is it to increase their chance to get the ladies?
So it's causing an echo, is what you're saying?
It's so loud, yeah. Like it's so much louder than if they're not in the metal pots, the plant pots.
Well, number one, love your conjecture. And you can turn it into a hypothesis, in other words, something that you can prove or disprove, by having an identical number of non-metal pots and scatter them around randomly. And if they prefer to go to the metal pots, which will resonate more easily, then you know you're on the way to a Triple J fun pack.
They definitely go more to the metal pots. We've got terracotta and plastic, and they don't go into them at all.
Okay. Wow. Have you documented this? Have you written it down? Have you taken photographs?
not photographs, but I have written it down. I am a bit of a citizen scientist. I've got an insect named after myself because I went and found one.
Well, I'd suggest you write a letter to Lucy Smith, ABC, your capital city, 9994, and if your documentation is good enough, you could be on the way to a fun pack. So, wow, you actually did it. You tried. You've got the terracotta and the metal pots. They prefer the metal.
But can
Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, Dr. Carl, can you speak at all to what it is about sound and that echo potentially that helps with mating with frogs?
The louder you are, the better, because you'll be able to attract more. And it's not always that the male attracts the females. It can be the other way around, depending on the society. And it turns out that a surprising number of our societies in the animal world are matriarchal, not just patriarchal, like the hyenas, they're matriarchal. So that was the first thing. The second thing is with regard to the loudness, the metal being thin and strong can be more easily influenced than to have the same amount of strength with ceramic. You've got to have it thicker.
Thicker,
and then it absorbs the sound more. So the metal definitely will increase the sound, but it's not necessarily that the males are attracting the females. I don't know the gender bias. We need a, I think it's a herpetologist who deals with frogs to tell us.
Yeah.
So, but definitely you've got pots of the same size and they prefer the metal ones?
Yes, by far. And I've actually, one of them, one of the frogs that goes in there has an injury, so I can tell that it's the same frog, and he actually goes to the same metal pot.
Wow.
And I've got various metal pots.
Oh.
But he goes to one in particular, and I know it's that one because he's got an injured foot.
Mate, you're on the way to a fun pack
here. They are doing it to make it, like, to make their noise. It's not by chance. I feel like they're doing it to make their call louder.
Yeah.
I'm following you. Now, you need to document it and see this many number of frogs on this many nights, and then that way you're heading closer to a fun pack.
Okay.
Thanks, Kirsten. I love that. We've given you some homework. But if you are into frogs or if you're a frog expert, you know anything about this, please follow up. Someone texting in saying, a world ruled by ants and a cappella frogs. Thursday never disappoints. Yes, we have already gone to a few different areas this morning. If you're just joining us, feel free to check it out on the podcast wherever you get them. And we are taking your science questions. Special shout out if you are near Hobart and you are listening today. If you've got a question that you want to send in, you could be in the running to win tickets to our Triple J 50th gig in Hobart on November 15 with Courtney Barnett, Luca Brasi and more. That is going down as part of our tour where we're going to five different locations around the country. Like I said, if you're in Tassie, you can get to Hobart and you want to come along, send in a science question and the favourite will win a double pass. Let's go to Perth now. We've got Natalie. Natalie, have you been dealing with some hay fever?
Oh my gosh, the worst, Lucy.
Me too, babe.
It's awful. I've battled with it every year and I've just noticed a bit of a pattern that it's really bad. Like my eyes are super itchy when I first wake up, even though they've been closed for 8 hours or so. And then also in the mid-afternoon, like symptoms flare up again. I'm super itchy around like 3 o'clock, even though I've been out and about in the pollen all day. So it doesn't seem to make a difference, you know, with antihistamines or not, but just notice this and wondering what's going on and if it's like a buildup of pollen in the eyes, like what's going on?
Mm. Is this immediately after you wake up or is it mid-morning?
No, it's like immediate.
Okay, so you've got different nasal drainage of mucus first thing in the morning and it can accumulate. Secondly, with regard to the hormones, you at around 4 o'clock in the morning, you will tend to start manufacturing cortisol to help you deal with the terrible stress of being alive for, oh my God, yet another day. And then the levels begin to fade off. Also, you have the chemical called adenosine building up and that also makes you tired and that has sort of a cross correlation. And do you take antihistamines?
I do. Okay. I take the nasal spray, I take the tablets, all of the...
Then they can be wearing off. And then the other thing is that you have been exposed to the potential allergens in your room for a straight 8-10 hours, as opposed to not being exposed to them in the daytime. And then in the mid-afternoon, often there's an outdoor pollen peak in some parts of Australia. And then physical activity can help. And then if you stop doing physical activity, it can make things worse.
Can you tell us more about the outdoor pollen peak? What does that mean? Why? Is there less movement or more movement?
Well, some trees and grasses and weeds have their own circadian rhythm, circa meaning around, diem day, and they will tend to release the pollen more heavily in late morning to early afternoon.
Oh.
So in the early afternoon, especially on a warm, dry and windy day, you can get yourself a bit of an extra peak there. Then there's your immune system varies during the day, and there are things called inflammatory mediators, and they can lead to a bit of a flare-up in the afternoon. It's a really unfortunate thing that your immune system is overreactive when it doesn't need to.
Mm.
Dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Just chill out.
I don't know. Got this.
If you can find something that isn't too expensive, go for it. But you've got great sympathy. I know some people who suffer from it. It really mucks them up.
Mm. I saw a news.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Natalie. I saw I'm going to butcher this, but I saw an organisation recently who are wanting to get hay fever and allergies recognised as a chronic illness. So then those things can potentially be subsidised and those things can be treated more seriously because it can knock people around, can take people out for days at a time. So
I had not thought of that, but that's making perfect sense because if there's something that stops you from being able to function at full potential, like looking after a 1.5-year-old baby, it is a genuine thing that stops you functioning. It is real.
And it feels like something that you can't really control. So, Natalie, thank you for your question.
Thank you, Natalie.
We've got Rory on Launceston. Now, Rory, you were gunning for those tickets to our Triple J 50th gig.
Yes, that'd be nice. Good morning.
Let's see how you go. Well, Rory, you are joining us from Launceston, and you have a question kind of relating to Tassie. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. I just had a question about the air quality. We often get told that it's the cleanest air in the world down in Tassie, but I think about the fact that we've got a couple of big cities and then we're not too far away from Melbourne and the mainland, and I just wonder why places sort of in the middle of the Pacific or something like that wouldn't be more so considered the cleanest air in the world.
The very first carbon dioxide sensor was set up by David Kessler in 1959 on one of the big Hawaiian mountains. And so the wind is blowing across from Asia and it's been diluted enough that it's pretty darn clean. Now, then other sensors were set up around the world, including one at Cape Grim, that jumps into my mind, over on the West Coast. So if you go to Cape Grim and you look out, mate, all you're seeing is ocean for a couple of thousand kilometres until you run to the tip of South Africa. So there's a good chance that the air is clean. On the other hand, there was a study coming out by some scientists in Tasmania saying that in the cities, you're getting tremendous increase in harm and death due to air pollution from burning wood. And so even today, one of the highest quality wood stoves that you can get, if you run it at peak efficiency for 24 hours, it'll put out in one 24-hour period, and we're not talking about starting up and cooling down, just running at peak efficiency, in a 24-hour day, it'll put out more pollutant particles into the air than a car running for 15,000 kilometres or a year. And when I was a doctor doing night shifts at the kids' hospital, if I went out in the middle of winter to do a midnight to dawn shift and I could smell wood smoke, I knew that the whole waiting room would be full of kids with asthma.
Wow.
And it would cost us a couple of $1,000s to take care of each kid. And part of it was just taking them into a bathroom and just running the hot water on full. And because we were a hospital, we could afford that. And none of the cost of that was borne by the people who were burning the wood. So, yes, Tasmania can have the cleanest air if you live at Cape Grim. If you live in a city, it's just pretty well the same as everywhere else, depending on the local winds.
Yeah. Okay, no problem. Thanks for your help.
Great. Thanks, Rory. We got Steve the postie in Belgrave. Steve, you've got a question about four-leaf clovers.
Yeah, it's been bugging me for a while. Just thought I'd ask about the genetic makeup for if it's the same as a three-leaf clover. I'm just not sure why they always turn into a four.
Well, luckily I wrote a story on this in one of my books way back in 2006. So each of the four leaves has its own luck, fame, wealth, a faithful lover, what's not to like, and glorious health. And part of that myth that four-leaf clovers are very rare is that they're supposed to be rare. And they're not that rare. In fact, we've actually bred clovers that are all four-leaf clovers. There's about 300 different species of clovers. The farmers love it because they're high in calcium, phosphorus and protein, and they protect the soil, and the livestock love to eat them either fresh or dried out as hay. And in addition to being delicious to eat, the clover has been colonized by bacteria on its roots, and per hectare they can suck 170 kilograms of nitrogen from the air into the soil. So that's without fertilizer. So the farmers love it for that. And the origin of it, the Druids, the Bible stories, the early Christians, lots of people talk about it. And in 1950s, the horticulturalists actually bred a species of clover that would always sprout four leaves. However, your regular three-leaf clover is not genetically different. It's just a regular three-leaf clover. But every now and then, if you give it some stress, like herbicides or diseases, including viruses, aphids, and in dry conditions and even cold nights or warm days, those stresses will modify the DNA. So the DNA is still the same, but methyl groups get added. It's called, it'll come to me in a minute, but we discovered this with the Dutch hunger winter, where women were, while pregnant in the Second World War, exposed to famine, and their babies grew up young, but when grew up small, but when those women then had babies, those babies were small. And what happened were methyl groups, CH3 groups, were added to the DNA, and the DNA is still the same, but how it's read is differently. And so stresses will not change the DNA of the clover, but affect how it's read, and under those conditions it can put out a four-leaf clover, and then it'll make you more lucky. And finally, with regard to being lucky, I thought we have to do this regular PSA announcement. Firstly, if you're consistently lucky, you will notice good things, and they will make your life better. The second thing is to follow your hunches. The third one is to expect good luck. And the example that this Professor Wiseman did was he got a whole bunch of humans, or at least university students who were close enough, and picked the ones on psychology studies who were lucky or unlucky. And he said, look, read this magazine, and we want you to count the number of photos, and at the end, if you get the right number, photos will give you some money. And the unlucky people just sort of went, oh, read, 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 read. The lucky people would, on page two, see a big notice that said, hey, and exactly this is what it said, word for word, stop counting, full stop. There are 43 photographs in this magazine, and everybody saw this. Everybody was exposed to the same message, but the lucky people saw it and the unlucky people did not. It's like saying, if you whistle, you'll be happy. I don't know.
Bright side kind of thing.
Yeah, that's it.
Steve, did you get all that?
There will be an exam.
Yeah, I think it sounds like I don't have a superpower for finding them then, because, yeah, I found 13 of them this morning that I've seen, and it sounds like they're a lot more common than what they are.
Wow.
but then maybe you're also a lucky person.
That's
in
true,
life.
Steve. Maybe you're always...
I think I am a very lucky person. Everyone calls me Tinny. I don't know why, but they seem to think I'm very lucky.
Glass half full.
Wow.
Well, I like that. So overall, to Steve's question, the genetic makeup is the same, but it's impacted by different elements.
By the environment.
Yeah, right.
And separately from that, there are some special clovers that have been bred to be always four-leaf, so their DNA was changed back in the 1950s.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
This morning, during Science with Dr. Carl, I'm giving away a double pass to our first leg of the tour in Hobart. So if you are able to get to Hobart, if you are based there and you want to see Courtney Barnett, Luca Brasi, Emily Waramara or Gordon's grandson, send in your question, put hashtag tickets, and the best one in today's episode of Dr. Carl could win a double pass to our Triple J 50 on tour in Hobart. This is just my Tassie fam. So here's looking at you, James in Nipaluna, Hobart. What do you want to know?
So my question is, I like to have a couple of drinks at the end of the day when I get home to cool down. And I've noticed that sometimes when I'm in a better mood, the alcohol seems to affect me much stronger and much quicker. I was wondering why that is.
Mood definitely influences how the alcohol, which then goes from the glass into your stomach, into your bloodstream, and then to your brain, the mood definitely affects how alcohol will turn have influences on your brain. So when I'm doing gigs, like Lucy and I at our fabulous show at the Enmore Theatre, I never have any alcohol before the gig because I've done that twice. And on each occasion, my family has said, you were sloppy, right? And you just weren't as good as you should have been. But afterwards, I have a glass of alcohol and it does not affect me. The second glass does. And normally I'm a cheap three-glass drunk, and by the third glass I've lost the gift of speech and all I can do is smile benevolently and repeat the last three words that anybody said, unless I've done a gig, in which case it's four glasses. Now, that's too much alcohol, so I cut back on how much alcohol I have. I'm keeping it down to maybe three a week. How many do you have altogether? We're picking on you here, James. I'm sorry. How many do you have a week?
Normally it's sort of two or three, but it's not, you know, it's not every day I'm drinking, but you know, probably 3 or 4 days a week sort of thing.
It is a powerful drug and it can knock off your liver in surprisingly small amounts depending on how susceptible you are. And it is involved with a whole lot of other things as well.
So to James' point, I think sometimes, you know, if I drink when I'm tired or bored, I feel like maybe alcohol doesn't affect me as much. That some people, you know, who maybe don't drink alcohol when they're sad, for instance, because they know it's only going to impact or further those feelings. So there is a connection between mood and drinking alcohol and how much it's going to get you quote-unquote drunk.
That's right. And then also I've come across a case in a few areas where the people behind the counter have been told by their boss, that person's been drinking a bit much, just give them water and smear some vodka on the edge of the glass. And they keep on getting drunker even though they're not consuming any alcohol, but they don't go to the dark side. And then another psychological factor is that the bar people who know so much tell me that dark rum tends to make people aggro and lighter rum does not, and I don't understand that. So there's a whole bunch of factors other than the alcohol acts on your brain. There's the mood and then there's the psychology of what you're feeling at the time as well. So it's a whole complicated mess.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, definitely agree with what Lucy said there. It's, yeah, when I'm definitely like in a worse mood, it's just it doesn't do anything at all.
True.
So.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, Dr. James.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Great question. We got Oren in Meanjin, Brisbane here. Oren, you have a question about jump scares, but I'm going to need you to talk us through this one. What's going on?
Yeah, g'day, doctors. I hope you're both well. Yeah, a bit of an odd one. I've mentioned it to a few people and no one knows what I'm talking about. When I get scared, only in real life, so not jump scares in movies or TV shows or anything, I get a really strong metallic taste in my mouth, like I've been sucking on a coin. And no one knows what I'm talking about. It seems to only be me. And it's never really bothered me, but it's just something I've been curious about.
Wow.
And I thought maybe you guys might have the answer.
So are in a situation where, say, I don't know, you're walking through a house and then a friend jumps out and scares you and you get a bit of a jump scare like that, and that's where you feel that metallic taste in your mouth. Is there a sensation that goes along with that?
Oh, no, is this a word that's in the dictionary? Jump scare?
Sorry. Is it?
We'll ask the audience to come and text us in the answer on 0439 very fast jet 757555.
I think it's in the Cambridge Dictionary.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, in that case, yes.
It might be.
Okay, here's a question that might seem irrelevant, James. How's your teeth? How's your dental care?
Good.
Do you use a mechanical toothbrush or electric?
I used to use an electric. I've now moved to mechanical because I lost the charge of the electric.
You lost the charge. Okay. On one hand, when you're scared, hormones will come charging through your system. And the main ones that we know about are adrenaline and cortisol. And they will affect your production of saliva, but that's not going to affect you in the short term. But also, change how you taste things. And then now back to the teeth thing. And in some people, and I learned this from my dentist, who have got almost imperceptible gum irritation. If their gums are not in perfect nick, and so when you go to the dentist, part of what they do is they get a tiny bit of a pick and they probe how deep the pocket is in the gum around each tooth. And you should be able to go down to a certain distance and no more. And at one occasion, I wasn't looking after my teeth properly. And after that, I moved to an electric toothbrush on their advice. And I had to have what was called marsupialization, where they cut open most of the gums around the teeth and then let them clean out and then sew them back up again. It was really messy, but luckily it worked all right. I've still got all my teeth. But the dentists say that if you've got very mild gum irritation or inflammation, in some cases, when you get the jump scare thing, the adrenaline and the cortisol, you can release a tiny amount of blood, which tastes metallic. That's the best I got for you. That's the best I got going third hand from the dentists.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, no, not a worry. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We're actually getting a text on from Will in Melbourne saying, I get the metallic taste when adrenaline dumps in emergency services. Sorry, I get the metallic taste with adrenaline dumps in emergency services. So someone agreeing with you there, Oren.
Oh, at least I'm glad to know at least I'm not alone.
Yeah. Oh, always on Science with Dr. Carl. You'll find someone to relate to your query. Liz in Melbourne, what's your question?
Hello. Well, my question is about albedo. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I just want like a layperson's explanation of what it is and how it relates to climate change, because I keep seeing it pop up about like changes to albedo in different countries, and I can't wrap my head around it.
I've never heard this word before. What's going on?
It's a scientific word, and it refers to a number which ranges between naught and one, and naught is a perfect black body which just absorbs all the radiation that lands on it. So if you were to look at it from a distance, you just see blackness. There'd be nothing there. Mm-hmm. And one is a perfect reflectivity. So it'll reflect the world around it. And a 1% change, like say from 0.3 to 0.31, means that it reflects 1% more of the incoming radiation. So let's just run through that. So the sun is dumping onto the ground, when the sun is directly overhead, 1,000 watts per square meter, and half of that is heat and half of that is light, and a tiny bit is ultraviolet, roughly. So if you've got a 1% increase in albedo, so from 0.5 to 0.51, 1% more of the solar radiation is reflected. So during the polluting 60s, before we had the clean air controls, which were brought in by the Republican government in the USA under Nixon, the pollutants in the air actually reflected away some of the incoming heat from the sun, and they lessened the effect of global warming. So by going to cleaner air for humans to breathe, on one hand, we increase the life expectancy of humans, but on the other hand, we increase the amount of radiation coming down to the ground, which increased to a small degree the global warming. So with regard to Venus, Venus has an albedo very, very high because it's covered with clouds, and you would expect it to be a lot colder than the Earth, even though it's closer to the sun. But on the other hand, the atmosphere is 100 times thicker and practically all carbon dioxide, so it's got a surface temperature of about 450 degrees C. So albedo is just a word meaning reflectivity. And with regard to global warming, we're catching 600,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of heat. And if you can reflect away 1% of that, that reduces global warming a little tiny bit. But even so, that doesn't affect the fact that the oceans are getting more acid. Is that a sort of a brief intro to albedo?
I'm getting a little bit more. I'm just picturing someone wearing a white shirt in summer versus a black shirt.
That's a good start.
Yeah, so yeah, some of the heat reflects off and some of the light when you're walking around. So I'm trying to apply that to like land masses as well. And so that's very interesting though.
And for no good reason, into my mind, why don't we have shirts that are made of sparkly stuff that reflects all the heat like a mirror?
Well, hang on. This leads in quite well to Dez's question in Cannons Creek. Dez, yeah. What do you want to know?
G'day, guys. Love the show. I just was wondering, with the amount of human beings on the planet being the population of around 8 billion and the temperature of the human body being around 37 degrees, if that's contributing to global warming?
It is, to a very small factor. I've actually done the numbers on this. So call it, say, 10 billion people. That's 10 to the 9th. Oh, sorry, 10 to the 10th. No, a billion is 10 to the 9th, so 10 to the 10. And then you got 100 watts from each person. So 10 to the 10, say, call it 10 to the 12 watts. So humans are radiating 1 followed by 12 zeros of watts. But the heat from global warming, where the carbon dioxide acts like a one-way valve and we're trapping 600 Hiroshima bombs worth of heat, that works out to 1 followed by 25 zeros. So there's 12 zeros put out by humans, but 25 zeros put out by global warming. So that's a difference of 25, 12, 13. So that's a trillion times less. So the actual heat from human bodies is microscopic in terms of global warming. Overwhelmingly, by a factor of 10 trillion, it's coming from the carbon dioxide and other gases.
Okay. And though, like, we're obviously warm throughout, you know, 24 hours a day, so that doesn't sort of contribute more?
No, but, well, on the other hand, in a 24-hour day, we capture 600,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of heat by the carbon dioxide acting like a one-way valve. It lets the heat in, but doesn't let it out. It lets some of it out, but the difference over a 24-hour day or any period of time is 1 followed by 13 zeros. So the humans are 10 trillion times less effective in generating heat for global warming than carbon dioxide.
There you go.
Awesome. No. Thanks, Dez. Hey, Dan in Melbourne, what's your question?
Hey, good. I'm just wondering, in regards to air pollution, in like a big city like Melbourne, how many plants would be needed to have perfectly clean air?
Air pollution causes the premature death of about 8 million people each year. And air pollution primarily comes from burning stuff. And when you burn it, the carbon dioxide doesn't count as a pollutant. That's, to some degree, plant food as well as global warming, but it's the oxides of nitrogen. So when you're burning something, the air is 20% oxygen but 80% nitrogen, and you create these oxides of nitrogen plus a whole bunch of other complicated chemicals. So if you had a city where you didn't burn anything, so all of the energy was provided without burning anything, you'd have really clean air. The only mess in the atmosphere would be maybe from construction sites and the carbon dioxide that people's breathing out, which doesn't count as an air pollutant, and then maybe some sweat. But so definitely plants do a good work. But if you do the numbers, with our current degrees of population and plants in something like Melbourne, you couldn't bring the air pollution down to zero. The pollution, I forgot to mention that, it's particles. So they're classified into two main numbers. There's PM10. PM stands for particulate matter. And 10 is 10 microns. A blood cell's about 7 microns. A hair's 50 microns, or millions of a metre. So they do not penetrate deeply into your lungs. But the PM2.5s, which are smaller, they do. And in addition to the particles, you've got the volatile organic compounds. And plants put off some of those, but in generally no, but mainly the oxides of nitrogen. And so they're the pollutants that we're worried about. So keeping on burning stuff and then covering every skyscraper with plants wouldn't work. You've got to stop burning stuff to get clean air.
Okay. Good to know. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Dan. You. And we've got Matt in the entrance. Last question, Matt. Dr. What's Matt, your hypothetical? Welcome.
G'day, how are you? My question is about electricity. So I know that, you know, creating electric current is, you know, a magnet through wire. If we had a long enough wire that went out into space, into Earth's magnetic field, would that generate clean, limitless power for the Earth?
Clean, yes, but not limitless, because of the evil three laws of thermodynamics, which, to summarise slightly wrongly, are you can't win, you can't break even, you're always going to lose. And so Sabre, I think Electronics, or Sabre Space in Sydney, a rocket company, have come up with the idea that every spacecraft that goes into orbit should have a little roll of wire. And when it comes to the end of its life, it pays out this very skinny wire for, say, 100 metres down towards the Earth, or a kilometre. And as it cuts through the Earth's magnetic field, it generates electricity. But also, you don't get energy for nothing. It creates a drag on the spacecraft and will then bring the spacecraft down out of orbit, down to the ground, and clean up space from space junk. So you could do it, but it's not limitless. There is a price.
Okay. No,
Thanks, Matt.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, we've been doing science with Dr. Carl, and I've got tickets to give away to our Hobart gig to this winning caller.
We often get told that it's the cleanest air in the world down in Tassie, but I just wonder why places sort of in the middle of the Pacific or something like that wouldn't be more so considered the cleanest air in the world.
Rory and Launceston, you are going along to our Hobart leg of our Triple J 50 on tour. Courtney Barnett is going to be playing it. Thank you so much for listening to Science with Dr. Carl. Full podcast is available for you. Carl, I'll catch you next week.
Peachy keen.
And that's it. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. If you want a little more Carl in your life, take a scroll through the podcast feed, or feel free to listen live and send in your question direct on 0439757555 from 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time on Thursdays on Triple J. That's where you're listening to this podcast. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.